The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
So do you think there should be a law in the books that bans the payment of ransom? I mean, you may have to actually outlaw the ransom payments. Are you ready to go there?
I would. I will say that. But I don't know that. I don't know whether Congress or the president is at that point. But I do think that we need to send this strong message that paying of ransomware only exacerbates and accelerates this problem. You are encouraging the bad actors when that happens. And I will say, you know, the president is really focused on the international regime of this as well, working with our allies. Every country, no country wants to be the victim of major cyber attacks, of any cyber attacks. So international, private sector, inside the federal government.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back and good afternoon. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We've got a great show lined up for you today. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about human trafficking, the ways that we can maybe improve our response to that and how we can help out some victims, but also discussing the scope of it. In the third hour today, we had such a strong response to the discussion about COVID-19, the Fauci email, the origin dispute over that we've brought back Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, and he will be on hand for the entire hour to answer your questions. I know that we had a whole bunch of people who really wanted to ask some information from Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He'll be back in the third hour today to do just that. But starting out right now, that was the audio that you heard was from NBC's Meet the Press Sunday morning. And it's regarding the national security risk of the ransomware hackers. And it certainly has been a corporate security risk for some time. But over the last few weeks, we've discovered that these are very ambitious hackers. They are starting to target key infrastructure facilities and networks. And that raises a whole bunch of very, very difficult questions about how we protect our infrastructure, our national security. Here to discuss that with us is Dr. Peter Pry. He's the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission as Chief of Staff, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. His latest book is The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America, 2001 to 2020. He also authored Blackout Wars and Electric Armageddon, the EMP Manhattan Project. Dr. Pry, it's an honor to be speaking with you again, sir.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And look, I mean, certainly we've talked quite a bit about the risks of EMP. We've been talking about that in terms of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. That's still very much a danger to American infrastructure. This is another danger which really is on the same scale and scope, right? I mean, if you have ransomware hackers or any other kind of hackers out there who are able to get to the national grid, the regional grids, the natural gas pipelines. We've seen it happen with the Colonial Pipeline. It's the same type of risk here. It's just a different method of destroying American infrastructure.
Yes, and if you could shut down the national electric grid, you know, which Russia and probably China can do by means of cyber warfare, you can basically end our electronic civilization. The Congressional EMP Commission calculated that if we had a year-long blackout, up to 90% of our population would die from starvation, disease, and societal collapse because we're an electronic civilization, and we can't live without it. All the other life-sustaining critical infrastructures, transportation, communications, business and finance, even food and water, you know, depend upon keeping the electric grid up. When the grid goes down, it's the keystone critical infrastructure. If you knock out that critical infrastructure, everything else will collapse within 72 hours. And one of the things the administration still doesn't seem to get, and the EMP Commission has been trying to educate everybody on this for many years now, is that these threats are all related in our adversary's military doctrine. They don't plan to come after us with just cyber. They're going to use cyber. They're going to use physical sabotage, small special forces teams going around shooting up transformers and control systems. systems. For example, like the Metcalf Transformer substation attack back in 2013, you know, that could have blacked out the Western grid had the bad guys wanted to do it that way. And then right. the ultimate cyber weapon in their doctrine, EMP, even a nuclear EMP attack, even though it's being you're using a nuclear weapon to do it, they don't consider that an act of nuclear war. It's part of cyber warfare because the electromagnetic pulse is a super energetic radio wave that will destroy electronics again, make the rubble bounce, you know, across the whole continental United States without creating a blast or radiation or fallout. I mean, if you were standing directly beneath where the explosion goes off, 300 kilometers above your head, you wouldn't hear it. You might not even see it on a cloudy day. All these things are related. And so when we see Colonial Pipeline being shut down and these increasingly aggressive cyber attacks, they're practicing part of their war doctrine. You know, they're practicing a part of it. And we should regard that as the tip of the threat, the tip of the threat. To give it a metaphor for this, you know, during World War II, the Nazis introduced a revolutionary new way of warfare called the Blitzkrieg.
Right.
And what this was a combined arms operation that combined armored divisions, which never existed before, whole armored divisions, mobile infantry and artillery, and air power. And ranging out in front of these forces, you know, were motorcycle corps looking for the weak spots in the enemy's lines where you could punch through with all these huge forces. So when you see a motorcyclist, a Nazi motorcyclist sitting on a hill, on top of a hill overlooking a French village, don't assume that the whole of the threat is that motorcyclist. You know, we're basically looking at the motorcyclist right now.
Right.
And exercises. It's a lot more than just shutting down the Colonial Pipeline or shutting down the meat. You know, this is the motorcyclist on that hill. Behind that is all the rest of this stuff, much more widespread capabilities to do a cyber attack that would shut the whole country down, combined with, you know, special forces teams running around with long arms, with the rocket-propelled grenade launchers and directed energy, so-called non-nuclear EMP weapons. In fact, I in a new book I've got coming out, I did it, calculated it, and with 20 directed energy weapon trucks, you know, this is a truck that would carry a non-nuclear EMP weapon manned by 40 personnel, you could attack 25% of the extra high-voltage transformer substations in the whole United States. You only have to knock out 9 of them to cause a nationwide blackout. You could attack 500 in 24 hours with the special forces team. And then, of course, the nuclear EMP attack, which is the biggest and most effective means of taking out everything, because it takes out everything at the speed of light. And you could win a war with just one of these things, just the way the Nazis could have won a war just with the innovation of the armored division, or just with the mobile infantry, or just with the air power. That enough would have given them the edge. But a good general combines all of his advantages, and the synergistic effects of using all three of these things together is overwhelming. It has a multiplying effect. And so this is a lot. The other thing is that, and I apologize if I'm going on at too much length here, but this business about the ransomware, you know, the administration right. is, I think they're deliberately trying to cover up the real vulnerability by pretending, trying to make the American people think that, oh, these are criminals in Russia, criminal gangs, and Putin has got to get control of them. So if by meeting with Putin, you know, this is a way of solving the problem. That is not true. You know, they're not even interested in the ransom. Yeah, the companies will pay the ransom. That's just part of providing plausible deniability for Russia. You know, the Russian mafia, you know, works hand in glove with the GRU, that's Russian military intelligence, and with the right. SVR, that's the successor to the KGB. They're an instrument of Russian state power. And, you know, that's one of the big attractions about cyber warfare, because it's very hard to do the forensics to figure out, well, who actually attacked us. And so by claiming that these are criminal groups and or independent people, you know, is just another way of reinforcing that plausible deniability. And I hope the administration is smarter than what they're saying in public, and that they do, I hope they understand that this is actually coming from the Russian government, and it's independent criminal organizations.
We're speaking with Dr. Peter Pry, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. This is a great information, by the way, and we appreciate you speaking at length on these things, Dr. Pry. A couple of points here that I want to raise. First off, this has not really been a high-profile issue, I think, until recently, even though ransomware has been around for quite a while. So I think this administration might not have been prepared for it. I'm not sure that the last couple of administrations were prepared for it either. We've been having, certainly the hacks into military systems and government systems has been going on for at least a decade, probably longer than that. But the most spectacular ones, go back to 2013 with the Office of Personnel Management, for instance, is one of them. There's been Pentagon systems that have been hacked as well. So, yeah, this is ongoing. This cyber warfare thing is ongoing. And it doesn't seem like it's been terrible. It's gotten the right level of attention until now. And I would say that there were a lot of people who raised an eyebrow when FBI Director Christopher Wray said this is on the level of 9/11 type of concern and priority for the U.S. government. It should be for America's corporate world as well. That at least seems to be putting it in the right scope, I would say, considering what it is that you're telling us here. Is that a signal that maybe there has been more of a realization that of exactly what the threat is here, and it's not just, a few million dollars from, ransacking a couple of corporate offices?
Yeah, even the Biden administration must realize that what they're dealing with is an existential threat from the Russian government, and what this is signaling that, yeah, they can do this. But let me give you some more background on this in order to understand, put this into the context. We have such short memories here. Just 1 month ago, we were in the middle of a major international crisis over Ukraine. Russia had mobilized, 100,000 or more troops on the Ukrainian border. And it wasn't looking like an exercise. There was great concern internationally, including by the Biden administration, that this was it, and Russia was going to roll over Ukraine, maybe even invade the frontline NATO states and take back the Baltics and, try to reestablish the USSR in that part of the world.
Right.
Which has been long been one of their geostrategic objectives. And we had been anticipating that there would be a test of the Biden administration. Well, that was one of the tests when they mobilized. The Russians didn't back off. They're just not ready to do it yet, because they wanted to see what the Biden administration would do. And the Biden administration, stood down. And I think they had to, because we're not capable of defending Ukraine. We would lose a war over Ukraine and even over the Baltic states. Even the Pentagon's own war game showed that we can't stop the Russians that run over Ukraine and the NATO frontline states in 72 hours. In the midst of that crisis, an interesting thing happened. There's a lady named Margarita Simonyan, who is unknown in the United States, but she's a huge figure in Russia. She basically is the director of the Russian media giants RT and Sputnik. And she's a personal friend of Putin. Those are official state media, by the way. They Yes. belong to the state. And she basically, so she's an unofficial spokesman for the Russian government through these media. And she gave a TV interview that went out to the whole world, and basically predicted that someday, and maybe soon, there was going to be a cyber war between the United States and Russia, and they would win decisively, because they were far ahead of us in being able to do this. And she created some scenarios and said, one of the things we could do, we could decide to select a part of the U.S. electric grid, like Harlem in New York, and just shut it down. Or we could shut down the whole state of Florida. Or we could shut down the electric grid across the whole country. That was 1 month ago, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, suddenly, we have Colonial Pipeline get shut down in the aftermath of the Ukrainian crisis. Now the meat gets shut down. Is this really, it's strange credulity that this is not the signaling by Russia to show us that their capabilities to do this are very real. And so finally, the administration, the responses they're saying, the acknowledgement that they could shut down the grid, that's healthy. That's a healthy response, that they're finally waking up to the threat. Of course, it's under great pressure, and maybe, hopefully, not too late, because the earlier examples that you were talking about, the hacks of the Pentagon, of the White House, the Office of Personnel Management, those were intelligence gathering operations where they were exploring our government and our critical infrastructures, looking for our weaknesses, stealing information from us. And previous administrations would kind of blow that off and say, well, that's not an act of war because they're just gathering intelligence, all right? But when you actually use malware to do something like shut down a pipeline or stop the distribution of meat, now you're using cyber means for destructive purposes that are actually, in this case, temporarily destroying part of the critical infrastructure, stopping it from functioning, denying the vital service that it provides. That's a level, that's crossing the line now into acts of cyber warfare. And this has happened on Biden's watch, and they had better, well, I'm the policies that they're, I am glad that they're energized. The president after Colonial Pipeline announced that it was going to be a 100-day sprint to try to protect the United States against cyber warfare, but their policies are contradictory. I mean, you know, one of the most important things that they could have done, you know, they haven't done, and that is they should have left President Trump's executive order. There's an executive order he passed, I think it's 13920, securing the U.S. bulk power system. And this executive order was designed to wean American industry off of electric grid equipment supplied by foreign countries, especially China, so that we would start building transformers and SCADAs and other critical equipment for electric grid here in the United States. You know, the reason for that was because back in October of last year, China demonstrated it could shut down the Indian grid. There was a border dispute going on between China and India, fighting going on in the high Himalayas.
Right. It was actually hand-to-hand, and there was two or three different skirmishes. Yeah. It made big news at the time, yes.
And it was exactly because, you know, they're both nuclear weapon states, and so it was limited to hand-to-hand because they didn't want it to escalate to a nuclear conflict. But this reflects the Chinese and I think the Russian psychology and mentality to say, oh, you know, we can't have a couple of rifle companies shooting at each other up in the Himalayas, but it's a safer, less escalatory thing to black out the city of Mumbai as a demonstration to China of our power. So Mumbai is 30 million people, and that's what they did. They blacked out the whole city of Mumbai. And the Indians said, we've got to get rid of all these transformers and SCADAs that we've purchased from China that are on our electric grid. They're providing them with vulnerable back doors so that they can make these cyber attacks. They're probably also designed to be vulnerable to EMP. And we've got thousands of SCADAs and hundreds of transformers in our electric grid from China. You know, so President Trump wisely was trying to solve that problem. For some reason I can't fathom, maybe it's lobbying from the electric power industry, but I don't think they're that powerful. The President Biden, on his first week, suspended that executive order. And it's still suspended. It still hasn't been reenacted. You know, leaving that's one thing to change that executive order and say, okay, look, it's a longer term thing because it's going to take some time to get rid of the Chinese SCADAs and get new transformers. But now is a good time to start doing that. I mean, this really should have been a wake up call that not only do we need that executive order back, but we need him to strengthen it. So, you know, it's a schizophrenic kind of a thing where they're saying the right things, but then when you look at practical measures, you know, like suspending that executive order, that's not consistent with what the president says he wants to accomplish in terms of shoring up our critical infrastructures.
Right. And I've actually got the EO in front of me, and you were correct. It's EO 13920. It was issued on May 1st of last year, so it was about a year ago. It was a declaration of a national emergency, which is typical for EOs, with respect to the threat of the United States bulk power system. Now, I think it's interesting that the one thing that we haven't seen yet is an attack on an electrical grid. But I would suspect that would be next in a sequence here. If this is a testing of capabilities for cyber warfare, for Russian cyber warfare or Chinese cyber warfare, I would suspect that that would be the next leg of the infrastructure stool that they would be testing against now. And that, I think, is that EO, I think, would be something that they would want to reinstate. We got a couple of minutes left, Dr. Pryor. I'll let you go off. I'll let you discuss that a little bit.
Right, sure. They might not actually do that because they might not want to disclose. That's their ace in a hole, being able to take down the electric grid. And they might not want to disclose their capabilities there. You know, I'm sure they can do it. Besides, they've had lots of practice against Ukraine. Almost every Christmas, they black out the Ukraine electric grid. And the Ukrainian electric grid is actually harder to black out by means of cyber warfare than our grid is, because the Ukrainians are less dependent on high-tech, advanced generation electronics. You know, it has a lot of electromechanical stuff in it, but they're able to do that. So if they can take out Ukraine, which they can, you know, it can certainly take us out.
Yeah, we're talking about the electric grid here. I just want to clarify this. We're talking about the electric grid. This is we saw this actually in Texas. Texas has its own electric grid, and it ended up being you know, shut down, if you will, or at least in great part shut down because of adverse weather effects and a certain lack of preparation for the rare winter storms that might hit in that region. But you get an idea, I think, from that, Dr. Pryor, the type of damage that this can do. We got about 1 minute left.
Right, and so do the Russians and the Chinese and the North Koreans. You know, they follow the news. They know what happens to our electric grid. That's another reason why they might not actually have to attack it to prove anything to themselves. If they did it, it would might be as a demonstration to us. And think about this. This is the other thing. The biggest problem with our, and the reason we haven't made progress for 20 years, is we're following the wrong grand strategy. You know, the administration wants a public-private partnership where the government is the junior partner in national security. That's not going to work. You know, the utilities are not from a national security culture. They're from a culture about making profit and providing convenience to their customers. And you can see that in Texas, for example, and in California, where they didn't spend the money necessary to protect against that rare ice storm, or in California against the high winds that caused all those forest fires. So you can't expect them to spend money on things like EMP and cyber warfare. They don't even understand those threats.
Yep. And Dr. Peter Pryor, thank you so much for your time today. That's obviously something that the government needs to be more focused on. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
So much of handling sports is handling pressure. Well, what pressure do you have if you're 0-for-12 and you're at the plate versus someone that is fighting for their life, versus someone that, you know, we picked up on the side of the street in Haiti because they're crippled or they're not wanted or they're thrown in the garbage? Like, how do you compare those things? And for me, there's not a comparison, and that's why you're able to handle sports as a game, because it still is. Yeah, we can pursue it, we can give so much of our time, energy, and effort to it, but at the end of the day, I know that's not why I'm here. It's not my biggest purpose, it's not my biggest calling, it's not what I want to be, it's not how I want to be known in my life. It's not as a football player, as a baseball player, as, you know, someone that, you know, worked hard to accomplish those things. I want my life to be so much more than that.
The Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. The audio you just heard is it's part of maybe one of the more feel-good stories that we have on the table these days. And here to discuss that is the man I call the Prince of Twitter, Andrew Malcolm, who now writes at redstate.com and who is often my co-host on the Ed Morrissey Show. In fact, every Tuesday he's on my show on the Ed Morrissey Show. And he wrote a really great column about the Tim Tebow story, Tim Tebow returning to football, what that means and what it says. And Andrew, welcome back. Great to talk to you today.
Thank you. Let's just be clear, Ed. It isn't occasionally on Tuesdays. It's every Tuesday.
It's every Tuesday. Yes, I was. That was a little bit of an understatement. It's been every Tuesday for about 13 years with Andrew, and so we are used to spending Tuesday afternoons with each other. And
yeah, we are. And it's a wonderful place to go. But listen, what a wonderful story Tim Tebow is. This is a kid, I don't know how many people know much about him. I've never met him, but I have followed his career and, more importantly, his life and his life of faith. He was born in the Philippines. His parents were Baptist missionaries, and the doctors there told his mother that her health would be safer if she aborted this baby. And she obviously decided against it. And here we have today this Tim Tebow. He is I think he's 32 now. He's an amazing guy. He was a Heisman Trophy winner at the University of Florida as quarterback, where they won two national championships under Coach Urban Meyer, who's a Catholic from my part of the country, Northeast Ohio. And Tim Tebow then went on to play relatively briefly, I think 3 or 4 years in the National Football League, and they had quite an impact.
Andrew, I have to interrupt. He played long enough to knock my Pittsburgh Steelers out of the playoffs 1 year. And I still like Tim Tebow. I still like Tim Tebow despite that. It was actually a fun game. And yes, he had a short but fun career. In the NFL,
exactly.
His first time, yeah.
Yeah, he was playing for the Broncos, and then I think for the Jets. And the thing that impressed was he didn't invent it, but he was kneeling on the football field, but not in protest. He was kneeling in faith. When something particularly good happened to him, he knelt in a brief prayer. That impacted me. He also started a foundation for people with Down syndrome, and he gives them thousands of them every year all over the country, and actually other countries as well. He gives them a senior prom. He gives them a night to shine, it's called, with his foundation, where they all get with orchestras and dances and decorations and food, and he goes to a couple of them every year. Well, he played, as you pointed out, a relatively short career, but a bright, shining one, is he's one of these professional athletes who wasn't getting in trouble for beating anybody up or being out at 2 a.m. or speeding, drugs, or anything like that. And he decided that he was going to try professional baseball. He did play that, I guess, earlier in his life. And he signed with the Mets organization and played for 3 or 4 years in their minor league outfit. And here's what struck me, Ed, and I think you too, since we've talked about this before. He was playing for, I think it was AAA at the beginning in Florida. And all of a sudden, their games started selling out.
Right.
And then he played for another team, and their games sold out. And guess what? The games on the road sold out. And even the road teams were selling Tim Tebow jerseys because all the kids wanted them. He had time for everybody before and after the game, especially the ones with special needs. Here he was, a professional athlete, and actually, I guess now, a multimillionaire. He's 29, these other guys are 19 and 20 and 21, and he's sleeping on the floor of the bus traveling to the next road game and giving his seat to the younger guys to sleep on. And the teams, of course, made a fortune on the ticket sales and whatever. Then he played last year at the AA level, I think it was. or maybe it's the other way around. I don't know much about baseball. But anyway, it was the level just before the big leagues. And he did very well. Apparently, the Mets decided he wasn't star material, although he was great commercial success.
Right.
And he retired from baseball this winter. He consulted with Urban Meyer, who is now the head coach and, I guess, in effect, the general manager of the Jacksonville Jaguars, one of the sad sack teams of the NFL. They got Trevor Lawrence as the first choice, this amazing quarterback from Clemson this year. And Tebow asked for a tryout. He'd been working out. He's in great physical shape, I guess. And Urban Meyer said, left it up to his coaches. They gave him a tryout, and they said he was good enough to come to camp and try out for the team. And he signed a contract. And Meyer has said it's going to be difficult. He hasn't played football in years, but now he's playing tight end. But he's playing tight end for one of the best quarterbacks that's come along in a long time, who's yet to play a pro game. But anyway, it's another one of these feel-good stories that here he is on his quest. And this is what I love about him. He's on a quest to do, as he said in that sound clip, to do what his calling is and to spread goodness and Christian faith of helping others, helping those who have special needs, but also others in his life. He got married, I think, last year. It's not just a feel good story. It's a do good story. And he wants to do some more good and thinks he can do it, by playing sports. And I'm kind of cheering him on. I think we all like underdogs.
As am I. And I think because it represents something, it represents how your mission in life doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be ordained as a priest or go into a religious community. Your vocation might be your vocation, but you're just called to do it in a fully Christian manner. And I think that is one of the things that we see with Tim Tebow. And it's also one of the characteristics, I think, that really threw off the news media. Now, I talk to Andrew all the time about media issues, and we're going to talk about a fairly serious one here in the second part of this half hour. But when the press was covering him, he's a very unique individual. They didn't get it. It's not like he's the only person of faith in professional sports or even in the NFL or probably even on his own team. He was just sort of a unique figure, and they kind of treated him a little bit as a freak. He was sort of a freak story, and they kind of insisted on saying, well, you know, he's just sort of this, doesn't really belong. This is very strange. We're going to cover him as if we were anthropologists looking at a new species sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that speaks also to the experience that people get when they try to live a life of authentic Christianity in the context of their vocations, whether it be, you know, a quarterback or a tight end or the baker. And, you know, Jack Phillips's, you know, Masterpiece Cake Shop is a baker there. I think that there's an automatic sense of hostility that come that you get from that. And we saw that and not just in reaction to Tim Tebow's authentic, efforts to be an authentic Christian in the public sphere. It happens to other athletes as well, but certainly in Tim Tebow's case, it was very pronounced. It was the characteristic coverage of Tim Tebow.
Yeah, it's very sad. In fairness, I should point out that, and I'm talking about the previous generations of journalists. Today's journalists are something else. I left my newspaper job more than a decade ago. But in those days, remember, journalists are supposed to be watchdogs on government. Today, they're too partisan, but in those days, they were supposed to be watchdogs. And you can't do that job if you say, well, I have faith. This politician, I'm sure, is a good man, and he's not stealing money. You can't go into it with that way. And so they are skeptical, actually cynical probably, about public life. And therefore, they can't handle faith or religion. It's hocus pocus to most of them. And you can see it in the coverage of faith. They cover faith as a religious institution, not as a human institution. It's disappointing. And if readers or viewers become informed news consumers, they can try to filter that out. But when it comes to cases like Tim Tebow, they miss the message. And he's more open about his faith, maybe, than some closet Christians. Well, that's okay with me. I don't have a problem with that. But right. It makes these media people uncomfortable. And therefore, they are writing stories that, well, he can't possibly make it, and he's only making it because the coach knows him. Well, here's the trick in that. Urban Meyer is the only college coach to win 20 games in three separate conferences, the Western Conference, or the Mountain Conference, I guess it was, with Utah. It's changed names now, and Florida in the SEC, and Ohio State in the Big Ten. He won national championships at the last two. He has a method, a methodology, coaching philosophy that he uses. And he's got now, he may have gotten more, but he has six players played for him in college at Florida or Ohio State. And he's got them there. He said because they know his philosophy, they know his work ethic, they know what he's trying to work on. And Tim Tebow is one of them. Carlos Hyde is another one. He just drafted Luke Farrell, who's another tight end from Ohio State, who he coached before retiring a couple years ago. So there's a sports story that's interesting here. This guy, who is a faithful Catholic, trying to turn a sad sack team into a winner, and it's not going to happen overnight, but he's got a process in place, and he's got the control to do it. One of his players is a person who's trying to live a life of faith. And to my mind, it's not just a good news story. As I said, it's a do-good story, but it's an inspirational story. When I read about Tim Tebow, I want to do some of those things. And, geez, exactly. Of all the examples of professional athletes that we have to show our children as role models, here's somebody who's never been in that kind of trouble, who's trying to excel in athletics, professional athletics, who's trying to basically make a comeback to do the best he can. Geez, I don't understand anybody who couldn't wish him well.
Who couldn't cheer that on. We're speaking with Andrew Malcolm of RedState.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And I think that the issue of coverage is in part because sports journalists have always been sort of a skeptical lot. I mean, it's sort of the characteristic of sports journalism. But also I think it's because there are fewer people of faith who are involved in journalism. And so the experience there comes across as very foreign to them. And most probably don't know how to write about it very well. And it comes across in a sort of, like I said earlier, a sense of hostility towards this, or a sense of suspicion at the very least. And I think part of that is what's at play here, Andrew. And I'll give you about 30 seconds to respond to that.
Yeah, it is. Suspicion is built into the job. I did it, and I've done it for over a half a century. So I get that. On the other hand, we were taught, or I was taught in journalism school, to be skeptical, not cynical. Skeptical is I'm going to look at this with an open heart and an open mind and to make a judgment. Cynical is, oh, they're all crooks, and I'm going to write it that way. And Tim Tebow is not a crook, I'm prepared to cheer him on.
There you go. All right. We got about maybe about a minute before we're going to get to the break. I'm just going to go ahead and set up the next story that we're going to go over. This is a little bit more serious story about journalistic ethics. ProPublica, which is a very good investigative journalistic outlet, they've done some very, very fine work in the past, has made a decision today to publish the illegally leaked tax returns of hundreds of the wealthiest people in America. And they're not publishing the tax returns because there are crimes that have been committed by these people or crimes that are being overlooked by the IRS. They are publishing these because they don't like the tax policies currently in place, and they are trying to make public examples of these people. This is an odd thing to do when with illegally leaked material. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
There's a lot of bad news out there for sure, but always remember, there's always so much more hope. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're speaking with Andrew Malcolm of RedState.com. We call him the Prince of Twitter. He's on Twitter at AH Malcolm, and nobody else has claimed that title, Andrew, so I'm just assuming that it's yours now permanently, the Prince of Twitter.
Yeah.
And Andrew has had a long career in the media. He's been in journalism for more than 50 years, and we often talk about media ethics, and there is a new story that's out today from ProPublica. I mentioned it before we went into break, and this is a story based on hundreds of illegally leaked tax returns from the wealthiest Americans, and ProPublica is making a very large it's going to be a series of articles talking about how unfair the tax system is. Now, this is a news outlet that prides itself on conducting investigative journalism into abuses of power. This is actually based on a rather egregious abuse of power. You've got someone inside the IRS who's leaking returns, which are private, and the privacy is protected by criminal law. They're leaking them to ProPublica for the purpose of manipulating public opinion on tax policy. And that itself is, a rather egregious abuse of power. Now, having received these tax returns, ProPublica is in a rather interesting position, and I would grant that. I would also emphasize that they've done very, very good journalism in the past. This is not a way of saying, well, ProPublica stinks, because that's clearly not the case. But I think that this was a very bad decision, and I think that this is crosses over into participating in an abuse of power and a manipulation of people's private information for political gain.
Yeah, you're right. It's very disappointing. We should point out that ProPublica is a nonprofit.
It is.
Therefore, they have gotten a special dispensation from the very IRS that they're embarrassing to get their charitable organization status.
It does have a
good reputation. But it's an example, I think, of two main things. One, of journalists and journalism organizations seeking to participate in partisan ways in public affairs in our country. And it also is an example, I believe, of government institutions doing much the same. They make a decision that something is shady, and in the government, which, and then individuals in that, in positions of power, affect the implementation of that power. You may remember back in a previous presidential administration, it was revealed that the IRS was systematically delaying, for political purposes, the charitable or the applications for 501(c)s of charitable organizations that some people within the IRS deemed in opposition to that president. Now you have recent investigations by the FBI that turned out to have been phony investigations for political purposes. So I think a lot of people have lost some faith in certain institutions in our government and lost credibility. And the media also has lost credibility. I think this will hurt. I don't know, honestly, this is just my own personal opinion, but if media could ever regain the credibility that it used to have many years ago, when, for instance, when I was working in it, it had nothing to do with me, but it was just an ethic that you lived by, that you had to present both sides in a fair and non-distorted manner. In this case, excuse me, as you point out, a journalism organization has decided it doesn't like the law, and it's going to change the law by violating the law. You know, I mean, I don't know how professionals can justify doing that. You know, it's like the old in Vietnam War where they say we have to blow up the town to save it.
Right.
You just can't do it. Laws are laws, and if you don't like them, you seek to change them, but you can't go out and openly flaunt them as these people are.
Right.
The crime that these people have committed, whose tax returns these are, is that they were very successful in whatever they're doing, and they've made a lot of money, and they are following the rules. As you pointed out, ProPublica is not saying these people are cheating, that they're lying on their tax returns or doing anything illegal or criminal. They're just saying that they're following the rules very successfully. And, you know, I'd like to have more taxes on other people, not on me. I would like to have more money, but I'm not going to try to take it away from somebody because they've been successful. So this is very disturbing.
Well, and I want to get into a little bit more of the ethics of this. We've got a couple minutes left here. There certainly have been times when news organizations have published, classified materials. The Pentagon Papers comes to mind because there were crimes being committed, and the only way to report on that was to do that. Work with whistleblowers, and I want to emphasize the point about whistleblowers. But whistleblowers, in that definition, are people who are blowing the whistle on people who are abusing their power or breaking the law. The only one that's breaking the law here is the person inside the IRS who's actually leaking these documents, and they're the only ones who are actually abusing power here. This isn't a whistleblower type of situation. There's no, like you said, and like I said earlier, there's no crime actually being alleged here. All that's being alleged is that these people are very good at following the close details of the tax code that's been passed by Congress. Certainly, there's a great debate to be had about the tax code and whether or not it's too complicated and who benefits and who doesn't. But this is, if you wanted to have that argument, ProPublica could have just as easily gotten some tax experts to come in here, model some, hypotheticals and show how much, people could avoid paying taxes at the very highest levels within the current tax code. They didn't need to have stolen tax returns to write that story or even to make that argument, Andrew.
No, exactly right. People and news consumers should always remember when something is leaked, whenever you hear that word leaked, your alarm bell should go off. there is an ulterior motive. There were leaks during the previous presidential administration because people who were leaking didn't like it, didn't like the president. They didn't like what he was doing. There are always going to be leaks. But in that case, many of them were false. But they're playing on the eagerness of media people who want to make a splash in this celebrity-driven age. And so they will tell them something that seems to be secret, like they are here now, revealing secret, legally confidential documents, showing them to the world because they have an ulterior motive. To me, that's not kosher, and I don't know how you can talk that we should have more equitable tax laws when you are not being equitable or legal in your presentation of the case. It's as I said, it's quite disturbing.
Quite disturbing, and I think almost the definition of unethical in basically abetting a manipulation by some unknown government bureaucrat who unelected government bureaucrat who wants to manipulate public opinion and manipulate policy. Andrew Malcolm at redstate.com, the Prince of Twitter at AH Malcolm. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. Stay tuned for the Chaplet.